part of the story is the world changes and organizations are forced to change with it or die. And the world that I see has forced us in the Bureau, the CIA, the Department of Homeland Security, to work more closely together, because while globalization helps us day to day, globalization during my day job is an enemy.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. My name is George Gillum. Coordination and cooperation between and among the members of the intelligence community has been a subject of some discussion the past few years. Some have blamed failures of communication between the FBI and the CIA, for example, for lapses in not picking up the 9/11 suspects who were living openly in this country during the months before those attacks. No one is more qualified to address these issues than Philip Mudd. Philip Mudd has been an officer of the intelligence community since the middle 1980s. He worked first on South Asian issues, then on counterterrorism issues. He was deputy director of the Office of Terrorism Analysis, the analytic arm of the Counterterrorism Center, at the CIA. In 2005, FBI Director Robert Mueller appointed him to a senior position in counterterrorism at the National Security Branch of the FBI. Now, how does one prepare for a career like Phil Mudd's? Phil Mudd earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in English Literature from Villanova University, and then a Master of Arts in English Literature with a specialty in Victorian-era fiction from the University of Virginia. Please welcome Philip Mudd.
I love those opening lines. How does one prepare for a career like this? One prepares by having the graduate program in English literature at the University of Virginia, which is one of the best graduate programs in the country for literature. Advise you that your grades do not allow you to continue your studies further. And so it's a polite way of saying, I didn't realize that I actually had to excel to succeed here. So my father called me one day. I've told this story many times, but it's so remarkable. It's one of those stories that you hear about but don't believe. You can't write it. My father called me one day and said the man who sat next to him at Miami Dolphins games, that was when the Dolphins used to win, said that the CIA was advertising in the Wall Street Journal. And obviously, knowing nothing about foreign affairs and having even less interest, I got my resume, which had a brilliant degree. It doesn't say on the resume, could not continue studies, which had a degree from the University of Virginia. Got in my Chevy Chevette, the worst car ever. I hope this is on the web for everybody who ever owned a Chevette. And literally drove on the GW Parkway in Washington to the front gate of the CIA, where the security guard looked at me as if I should be committed. And I said, you know, the pre-internet days, what do you want me to do? You guys advertise in the Wall Street Journal. You're not exactly listed in the white pages. What's a kid supposed to do? So that was 24 years ago. I feel like I'm an old man. And a career in foreign intelligence. But 3 years ago, I came to the domestic side. And I guess the story I have for you today is to give you a bit of an inside look about how the intelligence community works cooperatively, and sometimes what our frictions are, and I'd like to be open about that. I did think when I was driving sort of through the rolling hills of Culpeper down here today after getting off the pain of the Beltway, that this should be a heartening story for 11 a.m. on a Monday morning as the week starts, and I don't know if I can make it that way. I went over last night to see my little brother. He's just a couple years younger than I, with his wife. They, much to her distress, live across the street from the brother-in-law, and that's me. And I went to see my nephew, Jacob. Jacob's 10 years old. Pardon me, 10 days old. 10 years. 10 days old, little fellow. And I wondered what world that child would live in, and whether people like me and my generation would bequeath a better world. And I'm not sure we will. Let me talk to you for the next 20 or 30 minutes about what I mean and about what that means for the subject I was given to speak about today and maybe give you a picture, not just of how government and the intelligence community works together, but of why. So let's start with the why. Take yourself back to the 1930s and make yourself Melvin Purvis. Everybody is saying, this is going to be a long presentation. Who the heck is Melvin Purvis? I, of course, am saying it's going to be horribly short because I don't want to speak that long. He was one of the Bureau field managers in charge of the rise of people like the Dillinger Gang in the Midwest. And think of the world he lived in as the Bureau expanded back then, a world that was driven partly after its establishment in 1908 by the rise of the Model T. You didn't have a local sheriff who could handle interstate bank robberies, so you had to have a federal response to that. And then you had the regionalization of violence. Think again of Ma Barker and Babyface Nelson and John Dillinger. Melvin Purvis was front and center working that in the 1930s, early 30s especially. He was one of our special agents in charge. Fast forward to today and think about the problems Melvin Purvis would have to face, aside from gangs driving cars in an age that predated our ability to manipulate data and fingerprints and phone intercepts. Right now, Melvin's going to have to think about a cell operating overseas that maybe supports the Dillinger Gang. He's going to have to think about cooperation with foreign services. He's going to have to think about how to coordinate with the U.S. military and the CIA overseas, because we all work collectively with those foreign services. He's going to have to think about whether that gang has access to false documentation that will allow them to get in from Canada or Mexico, or, God forbid, fly a plane in from visa waiver countries in Western Europe. He's going to have to think in this country about cooperation across agencies, DEA, not only state and locals, DHS. The world that I see, in contrast to the world that Melvin Purvis might have seen 70 years ago, is remarkably more complicated. And I guess every generation says that. My life is harder. It's uphill both ways to school, and I was walking through 3 feet of snow in August, which is what my dad still tells me. I believed him till I was like 18, which explains why I ended up in federal service, I guess. But as I look at my young nephew last night and think about what world that he's growing up in, and I think about the life my father's led, I think about a world that looks increasingly complex to me. And I guess that's the first major message I give you. You all pay taxes. You hope you serve a government and pay for a government that uses those tax dollars wisely and that always does the right thing. And I hope that's true, because I've only served ever in the federal service. But I think part of the story is the world changes and organizations are forced to change with it or die. And the world that I see has forced us in the Bureau, the CIA, the Department of Homeland Security, state and local, law enforcement, the CIA overseas, and the U.S. military to work more closely together. Because while globalization helps us day to day, we get cheap clothes because they're made overseas, we get cheap furniture because it's made overseas. Globalization during my day job is an enemy. I talked about the world if Melvin Purvis, he'd be about 110 today, I guess. If he were working the problems we see today, how much more complicated the world would be on the counterterrorism side. Think about some other things we deal with day to day, and globalization and the impact on government and security and how it forces us as agencies to work together. Virtually every part of the world that I see has a downside related to globalization. Organized crime, the wall falls. After President Reagan says, Mr. Gorbachev, bring down that wall. We have significant Russian and Albanian organized crime in this country. You think about cyber pornography. One of the worst and most disturbing things as a counterterrorism expert I've seen in the FBI, not an area that I'm focused on, but I hear it brief now and then, is cyber pornography. A lot of this is coming out of Eastern Europe because of ease of access to the web. I used to think of pornography as a man in a trench coat on a corner. Criminals think of it as the easiest way to make money there is, one of the easiest ways. Put photos on the web and you can make a lot of money. Again, emanating from Eastern Europe, international problem. Think obviously about the counterintelligence problems we face, from countries around the world that come to the center of technology and not only steal hardware, but place students so they can steal research before it becomes hardware. Virtually every problem you look at, criminal, counterintelligence, technology, in the world I live in, is threatened because of globalization. So again, my first message to you is that the organizations that I see operating at an interagency level day to day are operating that way, not just because of goodwill and because we want to spend your tax dollars wisely, but because the world is forcing us in that direction. So how do we deal with this? Let me talk about architecture for a moment and talk about how we organize and how we handle these problems so that we don't have seams. I use that word seams advisedly. Again, if you look at the establishment of the national security apparatus starting really in the 1940s, post-World War II, tremendous seams. I think the CIA, when it was working against the Soviet Union and Russia, didn't have to think a heck of a lot about the FBI, except in terms of embassies and consulates here in the United States. I think in terms of thinking about criminal problems here in the United States, we didn't have to worry too much about seams in the 1940s. You weren't worrying about Albanian, Romanian, Russian organized crime. You weren't worried about human trafficking from Southeast Asia or trafficking in children. Seams are getting smaller again because the world is getting smaller. So first, you have the evolution, I think, of the way we're driven by the topmost policymakers. National security in the 1940s creates, in part, the National Security Council. Now you have the Homeland Security Council. Because the architecture at the federal level, I don't think, was designed to look at problems that are transnational in the way we have to look at them today. The Homeland Security Council and the National Security Council bring our officers together every week to talk about threat. This is increasingly a foreign domestic crowd. When you think about terrorism, even when I was working in terrorism in the mid-1980s, you thought about Hezbollah in Lebanon, you might have thought about it a bit in Michigan or California or Florida, but your focus would have been on Lebanon no more. So when you sit down at the White House today, even in the relatively short career I've had, you see a White House that includes more and more elements of a community like Homeland Security and the FBI. If you look at how we're operating then at the other end of the spectrum in the field, FBI has 56 field offices. Now we have a mushrooming of what we call Joint Terrorism Task Forces, JTTFs, 100 plus across the United States. Because again, these Joint Terrorism Task Forces include elements that allow us to reach across seams. DEA, CIA, FBI sitting together in field offices across the United States. Because when we get a lead in, more than likely, that lead is not going to be limited to Arizona or California or New York. You're going to have to turn to the next cubicle and say, this lead is reaching into the tribal areas of Pakistan. We have to work together. So you have direction at a federal level that's increasingly interagency, international, federal, domestic. And you have joint operations in the field across the United States that include members from not only state and locals as we've done since 1908, but include members from overseas because that's how the threat has moved. You think about also the kinds of people we bring into the service and how we grow people into the service. I got a call from Director Mueller, I believe it was July of 2005, after 20 years at CIA, saying, why don't you join the FBI and come help us bring the national security program forward? There are several dozen FBI employees at CIA today. There are CIA employees at FBI. We have people at the Department of Homeland Security. When we do security briefs with the director, often there's a Homeland Security person in the room. The briefer who comes over to brief often is a CIA officer who's designated by the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, to brief a domestic audience. I mean, think of how different this is even within a decade. Briefing foreign intelligence to the Attorney General and the FBI Director every morning. Fascinating. You think also about how the Bureau has expanded overseas. Again, because the seams are getting smaller and smaller with globalization. We have more offices overseas now, the Bureau does, than we have field divisions in the United States. Offices in Southeast Asia, Saudi Arabia, Europe. I think from the outside, and this was the bias I had coming in, this is why these interagency assignments are so important. From the outside, I thought, oh, the Bureau's expanding, sort of a Hooverian memory, I guess, of when the Bureau owned intelligence in Latin America in the 1940s. The Bureau's expanding because they want to do intelligence overseas. Incorrect. What I learned was increasingly, as crime or counterintelligence or counterterrorism has a foreign nexus, when we have a lead that reaches overseas, we have to have someone who coordinates with the locals. For example, if I'm looking at a cell in Minnesota that's recruiting people to travel overseas to Somalia, I better have somebody at the other end in East Africa who can help me pick up the thread with the local service. What if that person gets on a plane from Minneapolis and goes to fight overseas in something he or she views as an Islamic war? I need to have somebody at the other end, not just to collect intelligence, that's really the CIA's mission, but to work with the local service saying, do we want to pick this guy up? Do we want to let him go because we want to see what he does and collect the intelligence? On the way back, what are we going to do? Are we going to let him in? Are we not going to let him in? Are we going to stop him at the border? Are we going to stop him from buying a plane ticket? So increasingly, when we see problems or threat threads or criminal activity in this United States, we need to have somebody present on the other end of the phone overseas because the threads often reach there in ways that you would not have anticipated 15 years ago. So you have a change in the federal apparatus, National Security Council, Homeland Security Council. At the other end of the phone line and field divisions, increasingly interagency, overseas increasing bureau presence because so many of our problems are no longer limited to these shores. And then people like me, in what we call joint duty assignments, trying to learn about other areas of the business because I know, I hope I have some career left, maybe sort of kind of, except after presentations like this, if I make a mistake, it's over. So if this is on TV, please don't put it on YouTube. I remember doing testimony, this is totally sort of off the wall, but doing testimony a year, year and a half ago in Congress at a time when a lot of demonstrators down there, including demonstrators called the Pink Ladies, and they were anti-war demonstrators. And they were, when my boss and I were walking out of open testimony, there were a bunch of women dressed in pink, and I didn't realize they had that. They're so small now, those little handheld video cameras. I didn't, and they were, to confess, a bit belligerent. They told me I was despicable or something. I said, we need to have more than a conversation of 60 seconds for you to make that judgment. Maybe after 120. But anyway, I realized when I got back to my office, they'd already posted this on YouTube. So I thought I was part of a new generation, but I'm still learning every day the vulnerabilities of new technology. But as I said, architecture is changing, not because I hope we're spending your tax dollars well, but because everywhere I look, from ordering books to clothes, every item of clothes I have says made in China, made in Bangladesh, made in Sri Lanka. It's the same way in the world of threat. So let me spend a moment now talking about tactically what it looks like. I gave you a picture of mission, a mission that's increasingly international. I gave you a picture of federal and state and local architecture that reaches from the White House down to state and locals in places like Minneapolis that reaches overseas through our legal attachés. Let me give you a sense of how it looks. And this is where I worry about my 10-day-old nephew. Every morning, except for this morning when I was in my vehicle driving down here, we sit in the morning in a threat brief. That brief begins anywhere between 7 and 7:10 in the morning. We get in earlier to prep it, but that's the first conversation we have with the director of the FBI. And we talked to him about what's happening in the most significant cases we have in the United States. After 37 months, those cases are in places like Miami, Atlanta, Chicago, New York, Washington, Los Angeles, San Diego, Minneapolis, Phoenix, Seattle, Portland. They are everywhere. Many of them, especially in the world I live in, which is counterterrorism, are amorphous. This word cell is misleading. In the world of terrorism in the United States, I don't see cells. I see clusters of kids who are thinking about doing some act of terrorism, who may not themselves be terrorists yet, but are talking about acts of violence that might lead to terrorism. They don't know what they're going to do. They're not organized into cells, and they're not even certain they're going to do anything yet. I can recollect one case 2.5, 3 years ago. It began with a few kids who were talking on the internet. It eventually reached to about 15 countries, globalization, because they could talk over the internet. Remarkable. In many of those countries, we had legal attachés who were trying to work the other end of the case to ensure we didn't drop the ball, not only with the local service, but also with our local CIA partners. Obviously, if we're working those cases in a war zone, we're dealing with the U.S. military as well. I was out in Baghdad about 6 weeks ago. If you look at how we're dealing with problems in Iraq, counterterrorism problems, you sit in the room, U.S. Army, U.S. Marines, Special Forces, FBI, CIA, remarkable. Because that's how the threat has evolved. So when we sit in the morning, in my 3 years, I've seen cells from across the United States. Some are domestic, many reach overseas, very amorphous. The threat brief runs through these kind of clusters of activity and what we're seeing. And you think about the responsibilities we have and the pressure we have for interagency cooperation. I use the word pressure advisedly. Federal bureaucracies often don't evolve very quickly, and federal bureaucrats sometimes are turf conscious. I know this is news, it's probably a headline, but after 23 years, I've seen it happen all the time. But it's remarkable how sobering dealing with threat face-to-face is. You are an American first and a bureaucrat second, and threat forces us together. So when we see those threats come in, there's some tactical questions that come up. I think are pretty interesting. Our first mission, by the way, in looking at those threats, understand, most of you probably think of the FBI as a law enforcement organization. Our first mission is not prosecuting someone. It's not, believe it or not. Our first mission is to understand the problem well enough to dismantle it. This is a critical point as I go into giving you a tactical picture of how we handle these problems. Years ago, you would have said, how well did Melvin Purvis investigate the Dillinger Gang after the Dillinger Gang did things wrong, after they committed crimes? Notice what's happened in the evolution of Americans' understanding about the responsibility of their Federal Bureau of Investigation. Post-911, people don't always ask, how well did you investigate it? They want to know, why did it happen? And so when we look at threat information in the morning, our first question is, do we understand what's going on with this cluster of kids, this cluster of adults, whoever it is, well enough to ensure that if we take it down, we get it all? Our first question is not a law enforcement question, it's an intelligence question. We are an organization increasingly that's evolving toward being the Federal Bureau of National Security, combining a knowledge of a problem, a knowledge of a cluster of potential terrorists, with the capacity to do something about it. Knowledge is intelligence, the capacity to do something about it is law enforcement. Fused together, we provide security. So in the morning, when we see the brief, first at 7 with the director, 7:10, and then at 7:30 we go down and talk to the Attorney General. Our question is, what do we have here? Our question is never, let me be clear about this, it's never, are we, at least initially, are we over the bar for prosecution? We could be over the bar for prosecution. What if we don't know where the funds for that cluster of people came from? What if we don't know? What if we move too quickly to realize they have an overseas connection? What if we move too quickly to realize, had we waited another week, they would have met someone else on the street corner who would have been the key to a cell? So our first question is one of patience. It's one of security. It's one of intelligence. Do we understand this cluster of people well enough not to disrupt them? We're not in the business of disruption unless we have to be, but to dismantle them. Disruption to me is when a threat is imminent and I haven't collected enough intelligence, but I can't let the plot continue, taking it down, taking three people down, and thinking maybe there's another two. That's disruption. Dismantlement is allowing ourselves to be patient enough to understand, boy, I've been looking at this cluster so long, there's five people involved, I can pretty much guarantee you there's nobody else. Now we provide security by first allowing the investigation to run long enough to ensure that those are the only five, and then using our law enforcement tools, whatever they are, immigration fraud, marriage fraud, all the way to the other end of the spectrum, counterterrorism prosecution, to dismantle an entire cluster. I don't want to leave anything on the floor when we move. So when we see threats in the morning, those are our questions. Who are they? Where's their money from? Who are their friends? Who are they talking to? Who's their support network? Do they have overseas connections? Are they going to travel? If they're going to travel, who's going to get the tickets? This can often take a year, 2 years. I mentioned one of the units we looked at, one of the clusters we looked at, reached into something like 15 countries overseas. very patient work. And those questions, I sort of led you down the garden path here, lead across the American intelligence community. For example, dealing with those cells overseas, we're not only dealing with law enforcement services, that's why we have so many legal attachés, we're dealing with the CIA. What if we want to run a member of that cell overseas? That requires CIA coordination, cooperation, it requires unity of effort. What if we want to bring that person back into this country? Again, requires cooperation with overseas security services and the CIA. In that case, it also, let's bring in a third element, requires cooperation with DHS. Because when that person gets to the border, if he's on a watch list, we have to be very closely coordinated, first to figure out if we want him off the list, and second to ensure that that person at the border isn't going to tip our subject to let him know we're watching. Because if you take back what I said earlier, we may want to watch him for a long time, even if we can prosecute him. I want people to come in these borders who are bad guys. I want them here. Because I want to see when they get here and they start meeting people, who do they meet? Was that person on the scope already? Did we grade the person they just met as a third-rate operative? All of a sudden we say, oh, maybe there's something we missed there. Where are they going to get their money here? Do they have set contacts that someone overseas gave them? Who are they going to call? Who overseas stays in touch with them? If they're staying in touch with someone overseas, maybe that overseas person has different cells here we should look at. Think of these as network investigations, not investigations of a subject the way Melvin Purvis did in the 1930s. We are a service that is evolving in a revolutionary way, in ways I think most Americans do not understand, evolving from law enforcement and investigations to providing security by fusing knowledge of a target built sometimes over several years with the ability to use a law enforcement tool to destroy the target once we understand fully what we have on our hands. So you're looking, when we're looking at that threat in the morning, looking at overseas operations, looking at border operations with DHS. If it's a narcotics issue, obviously we're working with DEA. And then if the subject is moving downstream to New York or Charlotte or Miami, working on the group I mentioned earlier, the Joint Terrorism Task Force is in office to ensure that state and local police, sheriff, tribal folks understand what we have going on. We don't want them to pick that guy up either. So Melvin Purvis was cooperating with sheriffs. We're cooperating with ISI, the security service in Pakistan, CIA stations overseas in South Asia, the US military in Iraq, because we have kids in Iraq who want to come here. We're cooperating with security services in Europe because they have visa waiver programs with the United States. And if they have a bad guy getting on a plane in Europe who doesn't require a visa here, we need to know. We're cooperating with Border Patrol here, or Border Control here in the airports, because we want to know who gets off a plane. We're obviously cooperating with TSA, Transportation Security Administration, because you want to know who's on a plane. If it's a bad guy who pings against a list, when he gets here, you've got to cooperate in the field with sheriffs and police departments, with DEA, with DHS. If it's a nuclear threat, obviously we're working with our friends over at Energy. The world has changed so much that we've struggled to keep up with it. And it's a world that's changed as a result of globalization. So one last comment, where do we go? Where do we go? I think the Director of National Intelligence has headed us in one good direction, underreported, but something I think is critical, and that is pressing more people like me to serve in more organizations. Pressing senior executives across the US government to guarantee that they have experience in different agencies. All agencies have their own cultures, because as we deal with globalization, in different, we have to be able to speak with each other across the Potomac and across the United States and across the Atlantic and the Pacific. So an increasing number of people are being pressed into, required to, and some of them want to, perform joint duty. We have an increasing number, for example, of CIA officers working with us in the United States, not because we want to spy in the United States, but because there may be someone in the United States we want to send overseas. And we need that seamless cooperation of the CIA to help us. So when I look at my little nephew Jake, the world I see, if he ever sits in a threat brief years down the road, God forbid, I'd encourage him to go into English literature and maybe study. I went into English literature, unfortunately, when the David Letterman show was just starting. and when Budweiser was about $2.99 for a case. That combination is lethal. I've upgraded a wine, but it's the same story 23 years later. But I fear that his generation, like mine, is going to look back. As you look at the spread, for example, of video technology that can take you over the internet, people won't only be able to chat, they'll be able to talk internationally, multilaterally, real time, as they can do today by video. Travel will change. I believe, and this is a phrase I'd like to patent, but I think it's probably illegal for a U.S. government employee, and now I've admitted it to a national audience, so I guess I can't do it. But I believe that there'd be something I call the globalization of identity, that measures of identity with international business breaking down barriers, with international marketing breaking down barriers. How many bags do you see now that have French, Spanish, and English on the same bag? How many businessmen are operating in London and Tokyo in the United States and now Beijing? I think he'll be seeing a world that his generation will say is increasingly complicated. He'll look back on Melvin Purvis Mudd and say, boy, did he have it easy. Thank you so much. I'd be glad to take your questions.
Let me start the conversation by asking about what is going to happen with the change of administrations. There is always a great opportunity when there's a change of administrations to make changes that those within the bureaucracy would like to see made, and there's the opportunity for those in the incoming administration to make changes. What from the inside do you see as the most urgently needed changes, either in organization or in law? And what advice would you give to the incoming administration about some of the changes that were talked about during the recent campaign?
The most urgent change is to give me a better job. I'm not sure, and I'm not trying to be coy because I will answer your question. I'm not sure it's my role to squeeze an incoming administration with the hope that America has and by saying what I think they should change. I will offer a couple thoughts on some of the questions I think they will face. The first is, until you sit doing this every day, and I think this is one of the luxuries of living in this country. Until you sit watching this every day, I think gaining a tactical understanding of the threat we face from Somalia to Afghanistan to Iraq to Southeast Asia to the borders to within this country, West Coast, East Coast, I think it takes a while to understand threat as a tactical at a tactical level because you don't see it in newspapers every day. We still face an intensity of threat that I think if you sat in the briefs through the rest of the week with me would surprise you. The government has expended a great deal of resources and capability to fight this threat, and it still seems to me, maybe because I do it every day, that it's intense and that we need to talk to people coming in who maybe haven't experienced this intensity over the past 8 years about what we face. The second is, I think it's safe to say, with great resources, and this country has great resources, come great capability, but also come sometimes inefficiency. Shocking again from a federal bureaucrat. But we built up so quickly and so broadly to ensure that we try to keep this country safe that anybody coming in has to look at this massive federal architecture and say, is this the best way to operate? FBI, CIA, military, DHS, Joint Terrorism Task Forces, state, locals. We have Homeland Fusion Centers in many states now. I suspect there are going to be some questions, as there should be, about when do you recalibrate, step back, and say, is this architecture as efficient as it could be? I suspect it's not. Two more things. First, I think there will be discussions, and I think this debate has been sort of simmering for some time, about what national security is. You hear it both ways. The first way you hear is we are responsible as a federal organization to ensure that we don't look at people who haven't done anything wrong. People ask me, what's it like to be a CIA officer working on domestic security? I tell them, that's the wrong question. I'm an American. Every time I see a plot, when I walk into the Hoover Building, you say, Are we sure this is a plot? We're not supposed to look at people before we have some information that suggests they've done something wrong. And we've made mistakes, you've read about in the newspapers. But this balance between ensuring we provide the right protections and ensuring that Americans feel safe is very difficult. And I think the sands change over time depending on how much threat people feel. So I think there will be some discussion about what that right balance is between ensuring that we protect the values that make this country what it is and ensuring that kids like my 10-year-old, my 10-day-old nephew feel safe. Last thing I would say, and this is a bit further down in the weeds, increasingly I look at problems overseas of ungoverned spaces, spaces in the Horn of Africa like Somalia, spaces in Afghanistan and the Pakistani tribal areas, spaces in the Sahel, Mali, Mauritania, down in southern Algeria, where governments can't project power and where militants feel the capacity not only to plot locally, but to plot nationally and internationally. And I think some of those places, like Afghanistan was in the 80s or 90s, are magnets for people from this country in Europe to go train, and I worry about that. The inability of governments to project power in places where kids now can easily travel, read about them on the internet, and maybe come back to this country infected with ideas of jihad. That's a first thought. But no advice. They get a tough job. Have at it.
Thank you so much for your presentation. I appreciate what you said and how you approached it. I'm curious, what are some of the characteristics of the clusters of people you mentioned and the characteristics of their overseas contacts?
What's your name? No. Have you done something wrong you're trying to hide? Let me give you two major asterisks before I answer the question. First is, what we have in this country differs substantially from what you would see in other places in Western Europe and Britain. People often conflate us, pull us together. This is an area where we look a lot different. I was just over in Britain about 2 weeks ago talking to our partners there, and we face very different threats. And second, I think when you look at threat, two very different pieces of it. The first is anytime you have a cluster of people touch foreign terrorists, especially terrorists, for example, at the heartland of our problem, which is in the Pakistani-Afghani Afghan tribal area, the threat goes up substantially. The difference between the very small sliver of people we have who have connectivity into what we call core al-Qaeda, and the vast majority of people who have limited or no connectivity is substantial. As soon as that small sliver touches al-Qaeda core, the level of threat, by that I mean operational security, patience, operational planning, expertise on explosives, night and day. Most people we face don't have that. So let me just talk about that vast second category, the category of what I would call like-mindeds, people who are thinking that they want to join this global movement but don't really know what to do. Typically, you're talking, obviously, about relatively young people. It's hard to geographically isolate this problem. We've seen cases across the United States, Midwest, West, East Coast, Southeast, Southwest. You can't generalize by identity. For example, if you looked at Britain, many of Britain's problems would be second, third, or fourth generation Pakistani or Bangladeshi Brits. I don't think this is any secret. I don't think it's that easy to look at in this country. Often there's a galvanizing force, not a terrorist, but an older brother or father figure who can take them down a path. Once you get in this kind of group, it's like all kids, or all youth, I would say. Sometimes, and I don't know if Dr. Sadoff is in here, he's a psychologist, sometimes psychologists would call these exclusivist circles. That is, they talk among themselves and other information doesn't come in, so they start pinging off each other and start saying, why don't we do something, why don't we do something? And slowly but surely, they coalesce. Often the coalescence includes some kind of act that starts to cement them as a group. Paintballing, adventure camping, those are the kinds of things we have seen. And the last thing I would say is this is, and I want to be clear on this, this is not about religion. I'm not saying that to be politically correct. I'm saying it because most of our subjects, most of the people we look at, know very little about religion. They're angry. They're sometimes socially dispossessed. They're sometimes thinking that they're ostracized in their community. They are not well trained in religion. They think they know about religion. They do not. This is not a war of religions. It's a war of clusters of people who want to commit acts of violence and who think they're motivated by religion but are not. Boy, I was going faster. I need less caffeine this morning. I need to go to decaf. Yes, sir.
Well, thank you very much for this explanation of how cautious and careful you have to be in your business. I'm going to suggest something just the opposite, a recruiting poster that shows southern Afghanistan where somebody is squirting acid into the faces of young girls on their way to school. This is so outrageous. Can't we use stuff like this to motivate the young people in this country to join your crusade? And I understand that the new administration is talking about a public service academy that is patterned after West Point. I went to Annapolis, and I was a submariner, but if I could do it over again, I want to go down there and get those guys that did that.
Recruiting talent, believe it or not, for both organizations I've been a part of, both CIA and FBI, there's a lot, and I see, if anything, a regeneration of this among American youth. I'm here at University of Virginia today. I was at Stanford last week. There's a lot of talent in this country that is perfectly willing to sacrifice a paycheck to come work on national security. So I think you might be heartened to hear that I'm not sure we need better recruiting posters, because when you show up on a campus and wave a flag that says, we need your help, whether it's against organized crime or child pornographers or terrorists, there's a subset of people who will show up and they're quite talented. One quick comment on your remark about Afghanistan and recruiting posters. I'm not a politician, I'm not a diplomat, but I look at how this poison has moved around the world of people who believe that the killing of innocents is acceptable to reach a political end. And I think that we ought to take the high road and keep our message simple. And that is, I don't care what you believe and I don't care what you say. If you are destined to go down a road where you're going to kill innocent women and children, that's wrong. Stop. End of story. Indonesia, Philippines, Saudi Arabia, London, Washington. Different religions, different geographies, different political ethos, one message: you can't kill innocents. I feel a little strongly about that, so I'll chill, as my niece would say, chillax now. I hope she's not watching, because she will shred me.
On a different subject, the subject of piracy off the Horn of Africa, just this morning, I heard that they hijacked a supertanker.
Yep.
Before, they have hijacked freighters. They have tried to hijack cruise ships. Apparently, this appears to be a very profitable criminal enterprise. My question is, who should be doing something about this? Should it be the United Nations that's involved? Should it be NATO, individual countries' navies? Who should it be?
Boy, I'm not an expert on naval piracy, but I know there is an international coalition of, I don't know if coalition is probably not the right word, a large collection of ships from around the world trying to stop piracy off Somalia. And you're right, there was a major instance of piracy over the past day. I would reinforce the point I made earlier, and that is, with this spread of ideas, in particular, the idea that in the service of this concept called jihad, you can kill innocents, I see a world where spaces where people can't project force or power as increasingly a problem. I know I said that earlier, but I want to reinforce it. You look at where this problem emerged for us in the 1980s and 1990s. The heyday for al-Qaeda was in the mid-90s in Afghanistan, where you had the Taliban controlling territory, and the West, obviously, after the 1998 bombings in East Africa, for example, unable to project power in a way to disrupt Taliban and al-Qaeda. You have that now in the tribal areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan, plotting by al-Qaeda because political and military power can't be projected there. You have lawlessness in Somalia that's existed for many years now, and that has clear, I would argue, implications for us. Because we have problems emanating from Somalia in this country and in Western Europe. It's not just a an issue of the far shores of Mogadishu. There have been problems with lawless areas in the southern Philippines with the rise of Islamic militants there, people we call the MILF and some of their offshoots. The rise of terrorist groups in Algeria in the early 1990s, militant groups that massacred, murdered more than 100,000 civilians. They now operate out of the lawless areas in the Sahel, because people can't project power there. When you get these significant areas where you have an overlap of ungoverned space with people with radical ideas, you get a problem. And that's, we not only see it in the world of terrorism, you're seeing it off the coast of Somalia in international piracy. I don't know what we do about these. This is why I have the luxury of being an intelligence officer, not a policymaker. You don't want to project power everywhere. We don't have interests everywhere, and we don't have the capacity to project power half dozen places simultaneously. But it is a problem for security in ways that, you know, 50 years ago we would have said are offshore, and today they reach to our shores. All of these problems, Philippines, Somalia, they all reach here.
Thank you, Mr. Mudd, for coming. I had the pleasure of hearing you last year, too.
You came back?
Yeah, I came back. I want to give you an opportunity to embroider a little bit or enlarge a little bit on your comment about the need to rationalize the effort to opposing terrorists. And I'm, of course, asking the question, do we need 16 individual intelligence agencies with the budget that we currently have? And I think for many of us, the whole issue of homeland security and the creation of that department is sort of like impenetrable web. Can you talk a little bit about what might be in the minds of somebody who wanted to kind of rationalize this scheme?
This is a pretty tough question. I don't think of rationalization in terms of agencies. I think of it in terms of mission. What do you want to accomplish? I think we have the luxury now, I think, to be proud because of security services like the agency, like the Bureau, like the U.S. military, which has done brilliant work in Afghanistan and Iraq, and with foreign partners overseas that have a mixed record but nonetheless have lost many people themselves. The Saudis, the Pakistanis, et cetera, are criticized, sometimes rightly so, but they have lost many, many officers in this fight. But I look at it in terms of mission. We have a mission we have to close out in the Pakistani tribal areas. As long as core al-Qaeda is there, they have one mission in life, and that is to plot against us. We are the head of the snake. They will never go home again, and they're going to come after us as long as we let them live there. So the first question in terms of mission, how do you work on that problem? How do we think about working with our European partners, where increasingly we have common commercial interests, common business interests, common passport controls? I talked about visa waiver earlier. But at the same time, we see the rise of extremism in Europe. I think Europe is going to be a problem for us for years. You see these problems in Denmark and France and Germany and Italy and Spain. I'm worried about what will happen in Europe. So how do we make sure we partner with people in Europe to ensure these issues don't come to our shores? What do you want in this country? How much security do you want? Do you want security at every port or some ports? Do you want security so that we have more checks at airports or less? What kind of balance do you want? And it's as much a political question as a security question between ensuring that people live freely in this country and ensuring that bad things don't happen. I always tell folks, my definition after only 3 years in the Bureau of the mission of the FBI is to ensure bad things don't happen in this country. Well, what sacrifice do you want to make to ensure that happens? Do you want more stuff checked or yes? Do you want us to look at more people or fewer? And if you want us to look at fewer, we have to have a public dialogue that says, there's a prospect that there will be some other event in this country, but understand, this is a powerful country, not just in terms of military, but in terms of values. No person who ever attacks a city in this country will undermine the values of this country. Therefore, we do not need to overreact. They will not hurt us. Things that hurt us are gangs and drugs and pornography. These people that we face, that I see every morning, are a formidable adversary. but they are also criminals who have a vision of life that will never prevail unless we let it. So I would argue you take a step back and say, what pieces of the mission do we have to accomplish? Are there better ways to accomplish it? We've had 7 years to work on it. And what do you want us to do, more or less?
You're actually touching on exactly what my question was going to be about. You've referred to threat all morning, but you've really not supplied any examples of the kinds of threats that we're talking about. And
yep.
So what I'm curious about is if you're willing to briefly review a range of threats and to tell me how you all are prioritizing these threats. I mean, from a small explosion on a railroad track, which is not existential, yeah, to a major nuclear event. And that my second question, actually, is when you first make contact with clusters, are you keeping real good track of how these all turn out? Are you developing algorithms to decide when you've got a group you don't need to follow and which ones you need to?
Yes, yes, no, yeah, no. Can I get off the hook soon? Let me talk about prioritizing threat, because there are ways we have to think about this. The first, the smallest sliver is the biggest threat, and that is, again, people who touch core Al-Qaeda. If we have anybody who gets anywhere near them, that's at the top of the list, by definition. And we put tremendous resources on people like that. Couple other major issues we look at. The first is people traveling from overseas into this country. The network of security services around the world, we all have different motivations, different interests, but when we all face threats, there is a pretty cooperative network of services. If somebody from overseas has somebody traveling into this country that they tell us is a serious person, we're going to put a lot of resources on them. Obviously, the first question is whether we want them in here in the first place. In some cases, we may want them here strictly for the purposes of intelligence collection. Why are they coming? Are they going to help point us towards somebody we didn't otherwise know? Third category, something that's not very well known in this country. People, and they're not that many, but they probably measure in the dozens, people in this country who are traveling overseas for training. Not all of them are terrorists, not all of them will become terrorists, but when they travel to an area that's controlled by violent extremists, I can't sit there and guess that they just want to study. So there's a lot of resources expended on what these guys are up to, and again, they're in areas that are pretty difficult to access, so the intelligence architecture you have to have with our friends in Washington and with our friends overseas is heavy investment. And then there's this large other category. Let me close on that and touch on your point of algorithms. We see a fair number of people in this country who, again, don't know what they're gonna do. It's our mission not to look at them if they simply want to talk about radical Islam. It's a free country. You can talk about radical Catholicism, you can talk about radical Judaism, you can talk about radical eco-activity, you can talk about whatever you want, but you can't talk about committing acts of violence to get there. So we spend a lot of time ensuring that we strike that balance, not looking at people who are just talking, but also that if we have people talking about violence, that we look at them to ensure they're not going to coalesce. That takes a lot of energy, and it takes sometimes more time than you expect to figure out what the heck they're going to do, if anything. And when we figure out they're not going to do anything, it takes some courage to step back and say, we're not going to look at them anymore. Because one day, one of these guys is going to do something, and somebody's going to say, he was in your database 3 years ago. And so I'll take that testimony on and say, thank you very much. You don't live in this world every day, but sometimes we have to drop coverage on people, either because we don't have the resources anymore, or because you can't simply look at kids or adults who are talking. Algorithms. I'm not a math. English literature.
Wow, thanks a lot. This was a really great talk.
More fun for me than for you, I guarantee it.
No, for you, from you, it was great. My question involves languages, and it's extremely important to hire people who speak the languages. And I'm not talking about the Romance languages. I'm talking about Arabic. I'm talking about Hindu. I'm talking about all the sub-Saharan and South Asian languages. What are we doing about that?
We're trying. I think I would be misleading this audience to say that this is either easy or that anybody in the community, intelligence community, has done really well at this. Not for lack of trying. The folks who have the qualities that we're looking for have a lot of opportunities. And often many of them come from countries where the domestic security service or the federal security service is not a service they want to join. They came many times from countries because they want to avoid those services. So we talk to students, postgraduates who have these skills. Typically, obviously, the best people we want to look at are people who speak languages natively. That means also often we have to balance security with recruiting these kids for jobs. Many of them are first generation or they have families overseas. We've had a few, not many, but a few problems with people we recruited who aren't as trustworthy as we expected. If you look at the numbers we have, again, I would say we're doing okay, but not great. And the reasons are, some of the reasons are the ones I just mentioned. They have a lot of opportunities, you know, oil companies, for example. They don't always look at us as a career opportunity that they hold in great regard. And sometimes when we do try to recruit them, we have a lot of security hoops to get through to ensure we have the right people. This is really, really frustrating. Because you can see the fruit right there. Why not just go to a campus and say, hey, you got a great job, I'll pay a decent wage, but not a great wage, to do something really fascinating, and it turns out it just doesn't work out that easily. So I don't have a great story for you there. I have a decent story, but I'm not here to blow smoke at you. That's how it is.
You touched on this a bit, but can you share from your own experience what it was like to transition from the culture at the CIA to the FBI?
No. I'm going to sound like a Pollyanna because I guess you don't take one of these jobs and you don't stay in this business for 23 years without being an optimist. I'm an optimist that my little nephew Jacob will grow up in a great world. I'm an optimist that I'm on a good career path. Not. I came over as a result of a phone call. There was no paper, there still is not, that I'm aware of. There might be some in the bowels of some human resources section in CIA, I don't know. CIA still pays me. Not knowing what to expect. I had a good experience with my FBI colleagues. I had a good experiences in the limited amount of time I had spent with Director Mueller. And my experience in the Bureau, I would never give it back for simple reasons. Many in the Bureau recognize, especially at the senior executive level, that we had to evolve into a national security service. Not all wanted to recognize that. Let's be honest here. Some recognize it because we had a series of committees and also congressional pressure and media pressure that said, you better evolve. Some recognize it because they said, maybe there's a better way to do this business. Over time, I think we in the executive suite learned more and more about what change management was all about. That was very difficult, I would argue. Not because of cultural issues, just because change is hard in any organization, any major bureaucracy. I've often said, the director might have been better served by recruiting somebody who was a specialist in change management instead of someone who's a specialist in intelligence. I've been accepted in the Bureau, I think, because people recognize that it's a good time to evolve, and even if it's not, we have to. I think that I didn't join until 2005. That was hammered so hard for the first 4 years, 2001 to 2005, that let's not be under illusions. I came into the ground that was already a bit tilled. I think would have been much more difficult in 2001, 2002. And the last thing I'll say, and I hope he's not watching, I worked for one of the best men I've ever worked for in my life. Director Mueller's a great guy. He has a vision for what he wants to accomplish. He's a former Marine who operates with integrity every day. And I counsel new officers every time I talk to them, whether it's the Bureau or CIA. So you can have whatever job you want. If you got a bad boss, you got a bad job. And I got a great boss.
The loss to the community of scholars of Victorian era literature is the gain to the security of the United States. Thank you very much, Phil Mudd.
I've got to offer my closing comment. For anybody who thinks I bring analytic acuity to this job, the use of the word scholar, it took me 6 months at the University of Virginia to realize that a B-minus in graduate school is the equivalent of a D, and by that time I was out. Thank you.